I'm Marty Russell. I'm also from Emory, and I'm going to talk about risk assessment for these lesions that we're finding incidentally in the pancreas. My objectives, we'll talk about incidentalomas, we'll again go through solid and cystic lesions, and then a brief word about high-risk patients. So these are not going away. As the number of CT scans increases in the United States, these are going to be found more and more often. We currently do about 67 million CT scans in the United States, so we're all going to be finding these more often. So what's important about pancreatic incidentalomas, as you can see here in this publication back from 2006, lots of different pathologies can come from these. But when you look at malignancy, about a third of these actually have can have malignant behavior, so it's important that we watch them. The easiest way to start talking about these is solid or cystic, as Arthi has already mentioned, so we're going to focus on solid tumors first. So these will include adenocarcinomas, neuroendocrine tumors, solid pseudopapillary tumors, a little bit about autoimmune pancreatitis. So initial questions when you're looking at these, is the patient young or old, what's their gender, and do they have any clinical features? Now this is a pancreas talk on incidentalomas, so technically they shouldn't be having any of these, but oftentimes on further discussion with the patient, you can find out that they were recently diagnosed with diabetes or that they've had a recent evidence of a DVT. We've already been through the imaging features. So first I'm going to talk about pancreatic adenocarcinoma. So these are hypo-enhancing lesions on imaging. Epidemiologically, men have more pancreas cancer than women. The median age at diagnosis is age 70. So what do we do when we find these? We check the tumor markers and we complete the staging workup. And I think all of us in the room would agree that you have a pancreas cancer. It needs to go to the operating room. The question is what other steps do you do before going to the operating room, or are we shifting these patients more towards treatment beforehand? So this was an interesting paper that published in 2013 that looked at, are we actually doing too much for these patients before they end up in the operating room? They looked at 100 of their patients and found that over half of these patients were undergoing 3 and 4 tests before they headed to the operating room. And this subsequently led to a delay. Patients that were getting 5 tests, a 2-month delay in taking these patients to the operating room, which all of us would agree is not good for our patients. So this group recommended that if you had a clinical suspicion of pancreas cancer, you refer it to a tertiary care center where they get a CT triple phase scan of their pancreas. And if you had a solid mass greater than 1 centimeter without evidence of vascular invasion or metastatic disease, that you would proceed directly to the operating room. So that was fine in the way we used to do a lot of pancreas surgery in the United States. However, then we started looking at chemotherapy. So this was a publication in 2011 looking at FOLFIRINOX versus gemcitabine in metastatic pancreas cancer. And what we found is there was a significant overall survival benefit and progression-free survival benefit to FOLFIRINOX over gemcitabine, and 3 times the objective response rate. So then we started looking at, well, what about if we use this in our borderline resectable pancreas cancers? What does that give us? And as you can see, there's a significant toxicity associated with it, but guess what else? There's also a significant pathologic response that you can see in these patients. And so the question more and more as we recognize that pancreas cancer, pancreas adenocarcinoma, is a systemic disease, not just a local problem. The move has been towards neoadjuvant treatment for even resectable cancers. And this is a very busy slide, but these are ongoing studies for resectable pancreas cancer to look at neoadjuvant versus adjuvant therapies. So we're going to move into pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. Now, Dr. Maker is going to talk to us more about these, so I'll be brief for this. Just a reminder, neuroendocrine tumors can occur anywhere in the body. They make up about 1 to 2% of all pancreas lesions. There's a slight male predominance, and the peak incidence age of these is 65. They can be functional or non-functional tumors, and 60% of these patients will have mets at the time of diagnosis. So all neuroendocrine tumors are increasing in incidence, and pancreas cancer is no different. They can present as, again, functional tumors, which have a variable risk of malignancy depending on the hormones that they're secreting, or they can present more commonly as non-functional tumors. So looking at just incidental diagnosis, does that have any relationship to the risk of malignancy? And this paper was published in 2011, and as you can see here, incidental diagnosis in a size less than 2 centimeters was important on both univariate and multivariable analysis as to whether there was a malignant potential. And so I think that for neuroendocrine tumors, we all agree on what to do with the larger neuroendocrine tumors. Those should be resected in the appropriate patients. And then Dr. Maker will address the small incidental neuroendocrine tumors later on in this presentation. A little bit about autoimmune pancreatitis. As Arthi said, this can sometimes mimic a lesion in the pancreas. And so what do we do about this? This entity was first described in 1961. And there's various histopathologic findings. So you can see there in B, the plasma and lymphocytic infiltrates. And C is the storiform fibrosis. And then many of these tumors are IgG4 positive, which you can see in D. And then they also get obstructive phlebitis, obliterative phlebitis, which you see in E. So what do we do with these patients? They usually have either one of two types. In the United States, we see a higher type of type 2, and in type 1 is more described in Asia. So our patients tend to be younger. The males equal the females. They often don't present incidentally because they come in with the findings of either obstructive jaundice or abdominal pain. The good news is that in the United States, most of our patients are steroid responsive. So this is an algorithm you can use when you're looking at autoimmune pancreatitis. Again, you want to rule out malignancy. You want to take care of their clinical symptoms, and then you want to get them on to treatment. And most of our patients, again, resolve with steroid therapy, although rituximab has been described in patients that are resistant to this. Next, we're going to move into solid pseudopapillary tumors. This, again, affects young women, and they present often with vague abdominal pain. Often they're a large, solitary, well-circumscribed lesion, and as Arthi described, they can be cystic, solid, or mixed appearance. Some of these patients ended up getting an FNA, but oftentimes they proceed directly to the operating room, and there is a definite malignant potential of about 15% in these tumors. As with neuroendocrine tumors, these tumors are increasing greatly in incidence, in part due to increasing imaging. Interestingly, this study looked at patients who were diagnosed with solid pseudopapillary prior to 2000 and then between 2000 and 2012. And if you look at the numbers, 334 in the 40 years of the earlier diagnosis, and in 2000, in the 12 years subsequent to that, there were 2,400 of these. The majority of these are in women, as we described, and about a third in the head and two-thirds in the body or tail. When we're looking at how these patients do from a pathologic and an outcome standpoint, the majority of these patients, as we have gone to diagnosing more of them, there's less commonly vascular involvement and less commonly lymph node metastasis, and then the incidence of distant spread is also lower. In general, these patients do quite well, but again, the majority of them are resected. So now we're going to move into cystic masses. And for these, again, gender becomes important because, as Arthi mentioned, a lot of these happen in women. Age is also going to be important, size, where they're located, and if there's any inflammation. This was a nice algorithm that I found this publication from 2016. So is it a cyst, yes or no? Is there duct communication? Because if there is, then it's going to be an IPMN or a pseudocyst. If it's microcystic disease, then you're going to think about a serous cystadenoma. And if it's macrocystic, then you consider serous cystadenoma, mucinous cystadenoma, a cystic neuroendocrine tumor, or a lymphoepithelial cyst. And then other important radiographic findings, are there any mural nodules, which are going to increase your risk of malignancy? And is there duct dilation, which also increases your risk of malignancy? So moving on to pseudocyst, these represent about 20% of cystic pancreas lesions. They happen in patients usually with acute or chronic pancreatitis, also in trauma patients, but that isn't always the case. Sometimes they can be asymptomatic. Remember that there's no epithelial lining in these cysts. That's why they're pseudocysts. And on endoscopic ultrasound, you're going to find inflammatory cells. They do communicate with the duct, so your amylase is going to be high, and they have a low CEA. So then the question becomes, how do we treat these lesions? The majority of these lesions are asymptomatic, and if they are asymptomatic, then we can just watch them. We don't need to do anything for them. And then if we do need to treat them, the options of endoscopic versus surgical management come about. This was a recent meta-analysis looking at endoscopic versus surgical treatment for pancreatic pseudocyst. It has lots of forest plots in it, but just to describe this one, this is for treatment success, and this favors surgical management for these pseudocysts. However, there was no difference in recurrence rates or adverse events. The hospital stays were shorter, and the costs were lower with endoscopic drainage, so the conclusion for this was that it was probably reasonable to start with endoscopic drainage and then move on to surgical drainage if necessary. Next, we're going to talk about serous cystic neoplasms. This is the grandmother tumor, so you think about older females. That's who gets these. They represent 20 to 30% of all cysts. They come in the microcystic or the macrocystic variants. And on EUS, you're going to get a low CEA, a low amylase, and they may contain glycogen-containing cells. So what do we do with these tumors? So these, as Arthi said, are almost always benign. And if the patient's asymptomatic, we don't need to do anything about it. If the patient becomes symptomatic, or if you can't distinguish between this and a malignant lesions as you might do with a macrocytic, then it's probably reasonable to resect. Do we need to even follow these? That's the question. So some people will recommend follow-up in 3 to 6 months, then move out to yearly. And again, these are elderly patients, so the chances of them moving on to surgery is probably pretty low anyway, so it's reasonable to probably stop after that. As these tumors get larger, they obviously become more symptomatic. And then you can see the spike there in this publication back in 2008, and they're continuing to increase. But if you look at the number of patients we're intervening on in this diagram, in 2008, the vast majority of these were observed. And then finally, we have mucinous cystic neoplasm. So you think about these are the mother tumors. They happen in women in their 40s. They're usually in the body and tail. There's no communication with the pancreas duct. EUS, again, is helpful in these because they have a high CEA and a low amylase. And there is a very real risk of malignant transformation, so a lot of these require treatment. This looked at 163 patients in the, who had mucinous cystic neoplasm. The important thing here is the mucinous cystic neoplasm literature used to be contaminated with a lot of side branch IPMNs, which are very different histology. And so the important thing that you want to look for is ovarian stroma. So if you look at only those patients with ovarian stroma, then it becomes a very uniform group. All women, all in their, are the vast majority of women, in their 40s, the vast majority of distal lesions. And then the risk of cancer is real, from 3 to 44% in this series. In this series, again, looked at what are the predictors of malignancy. And as you can see, size and the presence of mural nodules or papilla increases the risk of malignancy. Looking at 5-year disease-specific survival, if the patients have anything other than invasive cancer, they do quite well. But the patients with invasive cancer have 57% 5-year disease-specific survival. So what's the big deal about these tumors? Why do they make us a little bit nervous? Well, they're happening in young women. None of us want any young woman to go on to develop pancreas cancer. They also, when we resect these lesions, there's a continuum, so they're not all invasive cancer. There's some continuum that they go from being adenomas and borderline to frank cancer, and we don't really have a good idea of when that happens. And then finally, these are happening in the body and tail of the pancreas, and so if you think about we're doing distal panks or distal panks spleens, which is not a Whipple, so we tend to be a little bit more aggressive. But are we overestimating the malignant potential? Again, size is incredibly important when deciding if these are malignant or not. And this was an interesting study. This was a small study of 38 patients, but then they combined their patients with an additional 5 studies looking at whether patients had high-grade dysplasia or low-grade dysplasia. And they used a cutoff of 3 centimeters there on the dotted line. And there were only 2 patients in the high-grade dysplasia group across all these studies that had tumors that were 3 centimeters or less. And so when they looked at the whole, on the whole, there were 385 patients in the whole series. If they observed cysts that were less than 3 centimeters and had no mural nodules, because one of the patients actually did have a mural nodule, then only one of the patients of those 385 would have high-grade dysplasia or invasive cancer. And so we have to decide if that's the risk of doing distal panc spleens on all these patients. And finally, Dr. Ahmed is going to talk about IPMNs, so I'm not going to belabor the point, just to say that there are a branch duct on the right and main duct on the left. Again, these are a little bit different. They happen more in men. EUS, again, is helpful because of the CEA being elevated and the amylase being low, and then they do have a very real malignant potential as well. So this is a nice diagram. I'm not going to go over IPMNs, but serous cyst adenomas, again, we only resect them if they're symptomatic. MCNs, we used to say resect everyone. Is there a role for just watching tumors, especially those less than 3 centimeters? And one of the things that may help us decide on what we should do with these is cyst analysis. So as we said, cyst fluid greater than 192, with a CEA greater than 192, that's predictive of a mucinous lesion, so it doesn't necessarily correlate with malignancy, but it is good for telling us if it's mucinous or not. Cytology has a very limited sensitivity. But there is increasing evidence that when you look at DNA and loss of heterozygosity for some tumor suppression genes and KRAS mutations, that those may correlate with malignancy. And then a recent publication in 2018 looked at whether surgeons changed their management of these cysts based on these analysis, and it is possible. So finally, just one slide on high-risk patients. So we've discussed all the regular risks, the patients at normal risk for pancreas cancer. There are patients who have high risk. Those patients are those with a history of pancreas cancer or certain types of genetic mutations or hereditary pancreatitis. And so these patients are going to have a much higher risk for pancreas cancer. And so we may need to follow them a little bit more closely than we would the general population. So in conclusion, the incidence of pancreatic incidentalomas is increasing. True solid lesions have a very real risk of malignancy, and so those should be considered for resection. Remember when you're thinking about these autoimmune pancreatitis, and then cystic lesions have a variable risk for malignancy. You use the imaging and the EUS features to decide on whether you operate, but maybe in the future we'll have some more detailed analysis on DNA and the risk of malignancy within cyst fluid. Thank you very much.